This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Tomorrow is John Lennon's birthday. The former Beatle, who was murdered in 1980, would have been 70 years old. Several celebrations are planned to honor the event, including today's edition of Fresh Air. That's Instant Karma, one of the songs included in a new 11-CD box set called John Lennon's Signature. Also released this week, Double Fantasy Stripped Down, a CD including bare-bones recordings of John Lennon's first mainstream album with his wife, Yoko Ono. On today's show, we'll hear interviews Terry recorded with Ringo Starr, with John Lennon's first wife, Cynthia, and with an author who investigated the FBI's investigation of John Lennon. We'll begin with Lennon's songwriting partner, Paul McCartney. Terry spoke with McCartney in 2001 about his collection of old and new poems titled Blackbird Singing. One of the poems was written for John. Terry asked him to read it.
This poem's called Here Today. It was originally a song I recorded for John Lennon. And if I said I really knew you well, what would your answer be if you were here today? Well, knowing you, you'd probably laugh and say that we were worlds apart if you were here today. But as for me, I still remember how it was before, and I'm holding back the tears no more. I love you. What about the time we met? Well, I suppose you could say that we were playing hard to get, didn't understand a thing, but we could always sing. What about the night we cried? Because there wasn't any reason left to keep it all inside. Never understood a word. But you were always there with a smile. And if I say I really loved you and was glad you came along, then you were here today, for you were in my song. Here today.
When did you write this?
I wrote that shortly after John died.
What was the night that we cried that you referred to in the poem?
I seem to remember we had some time off in Key West, Florida. And it was because there was a hurricane and we'd been diverted, I think, from Jacksonville. So we had to spend a night or two in Key West, is where we ended up anyway. And at that age, with that much time on our hands, we didn't really know what to do with it, except get drunk. And so that was what we did. And we stayed up all night, talking, like it was going out of style. And at some point early in the morning, I think we must have touched on some points that were really emotional, and we ended up crying. Which was very unusual for us because we, members of a band and young guys, we didn't do that kind of thing. So I always remembered it as a sort of important emotional landmark.
Do you remember what you were talking about that led to that?
Probably our mothers dying, because John and I shared that experience. My mother died when I was about 14 and his died shortly after. About a year or so after, I think. So this was a great bond John and I always had. We both knew the pain of it, and we both knew that we had to put on a brave face because we were sort of teenage guys, and you didn't talk about that kind of thing where we came from.
Now, that's the kind of thing that John really acted out through his music. I mean, he had a couple of songs that were really about that and were... Mm-hmm. We're very emotional. It's not the kind of thing you really did, though. None of the songs, as far as I know, were really about your mother.
Well, No, mine's veiled. My style is more veiled. And also, at the time the songs were written that you're talking about, like Mother, John was going through primal scream therapy.
Exactly, right.
And, you know, that's going to get it out of you.
Right.
I didn't actually go through any of that.
Paul McCartney speaking to Terry Gross in 2001. Our next guest on today's birthday tribute to John Lennon, who would have turned 70 years old tomorrow, is his first wife, Cynthia Lennon. They were married from 1962, 2 years before he appeared with the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show, where they superimposed the words, "Sorry, girls, he's married," to 1968. But when the Beatles were breaking out, pop stars weren't supposed to be married, so Cynthia was told to stay in the background. She spent much of her time at home with their son, Julian. Terry spoke with Cynthia Lennon in 1985.
What was it like in the days when you were a young mother? And John was mostly on the road touring, and he'd have, I guess, like a couple of weeks here and there in between tours to come home and play the role of husband and father. Was he able to make that transition from rock star and figure of fantasy to young father and husband?
Extremely difficult for him, because even though when he wasn't on the road touring, he was in the recording studio. So we saw very little of him. And when he did come home, he was so exhausted and so tired and so overwhelmed by the pressures of the outside world that when he came home, all he wanted to do was to collapse. And he used to sleep an awful lot. And he would wake up when we were ready to go to bed, if you know what I mean. With a small child, you have to be up early in the morning and then you're pretty exhausted at night. Whereas John's hours changed. You know, he'd be up at night and in bed during the day. So the whole fabric of our life changed because of the work that he was doing and because of the pressures from outside.
Were you able to maintain a private life of your own?
Well, my private life was with friends, I suppose, the friends that I'd known from college days that I kept in contact with. I frequently went back to my roots, which was in the north. I mean, we moved down south. And I had Julian, who I loved dearly and cared for him most of the time. Well, when I was there, you know, I'd sometimes go away with John on holiday. But the problem with me was that I had to cope with a household. I mean, we moved into a virtual mansion. You know, as soon as the money came in, we needed the space. So the first thing to do is, if you're a pop star and you get a lot of money, you buy a mansion. But that takes you from one extreme of life to another extreme. And John being away, the house was far too large for me to handle on my own. So all of a sudden you find yourself with a chauffeur and a housekeeper and a cook and an interior designer and all the things in life that you've never experienced before and you weren't brought up to, I was left to cope with and handle, which was hard work. It was a full-time job, actually.
Did you want to go on the tours ever?
Well, I was allowed to go on the first tour. Allowed, I mean allowed. But I didn't ask. John, I think John wanted me to go because it was so exciting to come to America for the first time. I'd never been to America. And it was a treat for me. It was really a fantastic experience. But that was enough. I wouldn't want to have done it again. It was just too much.
What, you mean being on the tour was too much?
It was just understanding and seeing what went on a tour. It sounds extremely exciting. It sounds wonderful, you know, different hotels and wonderful food and seeing new places. But all we saw were the inside of hotel rooms, the inside of Cadillacs. We were surrounded by mounted police on one occasion, motorbike escorts on another occasion, trying to escape from hotels. It was quite horrendous, apart from the actual performances, which were fantastic. The rest of it was horrendous because you couldn't see beyond the prison that you were in at that particular time.
Were you exposed to any of the groupies who were hanging around John Lennon and the other Beatles then?
Well, actually, the first experience, which was funny for all of us, when we first came to New York and we were staying at the Plaza, I think it was Murray the K was there. He was the first disc jockey that we'd ever met, American disc jockey, so I was very impressed, but he happened to be there. And in the room, there were sort of all these draped, beautiful ladies. This was their suite, Murray the K and about five beautiful model ladies all draped round. And we all walked in and looked at them and looked at each other and wondered what on earth we were supposed to do in a situation like this, because it was obvious. you know, what they were there for. And, of course, I was the fly in the ointment because I was the wife of one of the Beatles. So it was embarrassing for them and embarrassing for me. And it was a situation that clicked with me. I mean, I realised then what it was going to be like, you know, in the future. I mean, obviously, that was what it was going to be like, just women throwing themselves at them the whole time.
One of the changes that he experienced, which I would assume you didn't, at least to that degree, was the introduction of marijuana and hallucinogenic drugs. I mean, the Beatles became famous for mm-hmm. that. Did you participate in any of that? Were you anxious to try it?
I was never anxious to try it. But our first experience was a friend of George's, actually, a dentist person, and we went for dinner. And after dinner, he put sugar cubes in our coffee, which were laced with LSD. And, of course, it hit us all at the same time, and we had the most horrendous night and a very dangerous drive home. We could all have been killed because we were absolutely out of our minds. And for me, that was hell, sheer hell, mental torture, and I couldn't cope with it, and I would never, ever have wanted to do it again. And yet for John, it was something else. You see, John was a different animal. He was a searcher. He desired something new in life, constantly changing, constantly wanting new experiences. And, of course, he didn't have a bad time on this particular drug, so he tried it again.
What are some of the other ways you saw him changed by the fame and the money that he achieved?
I think he became extremely lethargic at home, really rather sad and tired. He just didn't have any stimulation anymore. He was losing out on concert tours. He wasn't happy in his performance because he couldn't hear himself. He wasn't getting any audience response. He wasn't close enough to the people that he was entertaining anymore. I mean, he was surrounded by adulation and material goods and all the things that other people would think were fantastic in life. But for John, it wasn't enough. It wasn't good enough. Wasn't honest enough.
So what did it look like he was going to turn to instead?
Well, I think it was very hard to describe what he was going to turn to. I mean, he was on that particular road. We did turn to meditation and Maharishi in India.
Did you go to that?
Yes, I was there for 2 months. But he took that wholeheartedly again, and so did George, very, very deeply into meditation. And I didn't. I took half and half, sort of tried to get a balanced view of it. So I would do artwork. Half of my time was doing artwork and half of my time was doing meditation because I didn't want to get hooked on anything. You know, I think you've got to believe in yourself and your capabilities. And I think John again was looking for an escape. But this time it was a healthy escape. It was escape into meditation, into peace of mind, relaxation, away from the pressures. And it was at this particular time that he met Yoko. And, of course, again, before we went to India, Brian died. So the whole thing, our whole lifestyle changed again very quickly, you know, after the first time. I was constantly changing. And this was a great break and a great rift for all of us. I mean, we're all devastated by Brian's death.
When John and Yoko went off together, their relationship was probably the most press-covered relationship of the year. They were on the cover of everything. Mm-hmm. They were holding press conferences in their bed. I mean, it was one big media event after another. How much of that did you want to expose yourself to? Did you read it?
Oh, I read everything, yes. Because, of course, the man that we had divorced, it didn't mean to say I'd stopped loving him or caring for him or worrying about him. Because I didn't have any anger or bitterness about it. I had a lot of hurt. But of course I was looking after his interests in my own little way and caring about his future and hoping that he was happy because he'd had to go through such hell to do what he did. And he became almost a leper in the eyes of the British and the press. And he had hell to go through because he broke away from the system of being one of the four mop tops that were doing so well and such good ambassadors for Britain. And he moved out of that and he became an individual. And he did what he wanted, to the extreme, as John would always do anyway. And I felt extremely worried for him, really, at that time, because he had to take so much from the press and media and from fans and people who loved him.
Did you hear about his assassination through the press, or did someone notify you before it got out on the wires?
Yes, I was staying with Maureen Starkey at the time, and she had a phone call from Ringo to tell her, so she told me.
Cynthia Lennon, speaking to Terry Gross in 1985. She now lives in Spain, where she's continued her career as an artist. Ringo Starr was the last member to join the Beatles. He came aboard just as the group's recording career began. Terry spoke with Ringo in 1995 when ABC was about to present a multi-part retrospective documentary called The Beatles Anthology. He explained how the new project led, eventually, to a new Beatles recording.
You know, we finally put it together, but it needed something new instead of it just being like the documentary. And so we all decided to be involved ourselves. And the follow-on to that was, well, why don't we make some music for it? And the problem we had with that, well, yes, it's really easy that Paul, George and Ringo can go in the studio and make this music, but that's not the Beatles. So we needed something that, you know, it would still be the Beatles. And Yoko came up with a couple of tracks of John's that have never been out there, just demos, really. So we really worked on them to get them, you know, clean enough and usable enough, really. And we put them down on 24-track, and then we all worked with that. So it just seemed like, you know, it's a natural progression. We're all loose enough to do this together now. And it made it real easy, because now John's in it.
Through the demo?
Through the tape, yeah.
What was it like playing together again?
It was very emotional. I mean, it was very emotional, first of all, listening to John on the tape. You know, because he is not here, but his voice was there. And then, you know, we had to, you know, we all called each other and spoke about it. You know, we had to say, okay, well, are we going to do this? You know, it's pretty strange. And we came to the conclusion that, well, what we'll do is we'll just feel, you know, we'll just sort of say, well, John's gone on holiday for a while, or he's gone for a cup of tea, and that's how we got into it. So it felt okay, you know. But we still have the difficulty of, you know, the three of us doing anything. So it was a lifesaver, really.
Ringo Starr spoke to Terry Gross in 1995. Ringo was the first former Beatle to appear on Fresh Air. We'll hear more about John Lennon in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. Tomorrow is the 70th anniversary of the birth of John Lennon. In his lifetime, during and after the Beatles, Lennon lobbied hard to question and change the status quo, sometimes in song.
Two, one, two, three, four.
Anti-war music like Give Peace a Chance didn't exactly endear John Lennon to the Nixon administration. In 1971, shortly after John Lennon arrived in New York on a visa, he began associating with radical anti-war activists, and the FBI put Lennon under surveillance. The Immigration and Naturalization Service tried to deport him. John Wiener is an historian who investigated what the FBI and the INS did to Lennon between 1971 and 1972. After Lennon was murdered, Wiener requested Lennon's FBI files under the Freedom of Information Act. Terry spoke with John Wiener in 2000, the year he wrote a book about the FBI files called Gimme Some Truth. It opens with a memo from Senator Strom Thurmond to the Nixon White House about an upcoming Beatle tour of the United States. The memo warns that John Lennon might combine rock music with politics and organize young people to vote against Nixon in the 1972 election. Thurmond's memo also suggests that terminating Lennon's visa might be an effective countermeasure.
A little historical background here. The 72 election was going to be the first in which 18-year-olds had the right to vote. Before that, you had to be 21. Everybody knew that young people were the strongest anti-war constituency. So the question was, for Lennon, how could he use his power as a celebrity to get young people into the political process? And also, this is a time when kids are very alienated from, you know, mainstream politics. So to get Lennon out of the country, the strategic countermeasure is to deport Lennon so he won't be able to take this tour that would register young voters. At the same time, they're worried that, you know, young voters will vote against Nixon for kicking out, the clever Beatle.
Now, how accurate was the FBI's information that John Lennon did want to help organize these political concerts be for peace and against Nixon?
There's no question that Lennon was talking about this with his friends, his friends being Jerry Rubin, Abby Hoffman, Bobby Seale. And they tried doing one of these. In Ann Arbor, Michigan, in December 1971, John and Yoko headlined a political rock concert, the Free John Sinclair Concert. Every once in a while I run into somebody who was there. 15,000 people spent 6 hours in Chrysler Arena. They listened not only to John and Yoko, but Stevie Wonder came, Commander Cody came, the MC5 came, William Kunstler gave a speech, Jerry Rubin gave a speech, Bobby Seale gave a speech. And a lot of it was about, you know, mobilizing young people to oppose Nixon. So they were very excited. John and Yoko were very excited about the tremendous turnout they had for this concert and how successful it was. So they were interested in the idea. They never got to the stage of setting up the national concert tour because the deportation order came down just 2 months later.
How far did the INS get in deporting Lennon?
Well, for much of 1972 and 73, Lennon was under an order to leave the country within 60 days. He had very talented legal help, and they kept getting these deadlines extended. There was a lot of people mobilized to support him, but it wasn't until after Watergate, after Nixon left office, that the Gerald Ford administration Immigration Service finally agreed to grant Lennon his green card on a very narrow legal ground. So for 2 years, he was under a 60-day order to leave the country almost continuously.
Now, let's talk more about the FBI documents that you were finally able to get through the Freedom of Information Act. You say that the FBI documents make the FBI look more like the Keystone Cops than the Gestapo. Give us an example of one of the documents that you think makes them look like Keystone Cops.
Well, there's one where J. Edgar Hoover sends out instructions to locate Lennon as quickly as possible. They say his last known address is St. Regis Hotel, 150 Bank Street, New York City. Now, every cop and cab driver in New York knows that the St. Regis Hotel, you know, is on Central Park. It's not, and that Bank Street is in the West Village, so this couldn't be right. In fact, Lennon at the time was living on Bank Street, but he was living at 105 Bank Street, not 150 Bank Street. So here's like this all points bulletin, you know, find Lennon. They're just confused. I mean, it could have happened to any of us, I guess. The other really strange one is that there's a kind of a wanted poster for Lennon. The FBI proposed that Lennon should be arrested, if at all possible, on possession of narcotics charges. I'm quoting now from one of the documents, which would make him more immediately deportable. And these instructions to local police officials include a kind of a wanted poster, a picture of Lennon, you know, height, weight, eye color, and so on. You'd think that they wouldn't really need this. Lennon was certainly one of the most recognizable faces in the world in 1972. They have a picture there anyway, but the strangest thing is the picture isn't of John Lennon. It's of another guy. A guy, I mean, I know who it is. It's a guy named David Peel, who was an East Village folk singer, street singer, busker type, who looked a little like Lennon. I mean, he wore the wire-rimmed glasses and had Lennon's style of long hair. Of course, lots of other people did in 1972. David Peel had recorded on Apple Records. Maybe that's how they got confused. So the FBI, you know, was lamentably out of touch with the mainstream, not just of, you know, the radical counterculture of New York City, but you would think John Lennon is kind of pretty much the mainstream in 1972.
Well, the funny thing is that the FBI documents, like, for instance, there's a memo from Hoover in which he describes Lennon as something like a member of the singing group The Beatles, as if, like, you know, as if, like, who The Beatles are really needs to be explained.
You know, I've always been fascinated by that sentence. This is in J. Edgar Hoover's letter to H.R. Haldeman. And the first sentence is, John Winston Lennon is a member of the Beatles singing group. Now, what I'm not sure is it that J. Edgar Hoover wants to prove that he knows what the Beatles are and the names of the Beatles? Or is it that he thinks that Nixon does not know who John Lennon is, or that it's this John Lennon, the John Lennon who's the Beatle, is the one we're talking about here? I've never been able to figure out which of those is the case.
Did you find anything in the FBI files that were released to you that indicated that the FBI went beyond surveillance, that they ever tried to set Lennon up?
Yeah, there's a couple of documents. Their concern was that Lennon would participate in some kind of concert, rally, anti-war demonstration outside the Republican National Convention. And there's a memo from J. Edgar Hoover to the head of the Miami FBI office that suggests that if Lennon could be arrested on possession of narcotics charges, he would become more immediately deportable. Now, this seems to me an effort to set Lennon up for a drug bust. The FBI doesn't enforce possession of narcotics charges. That's a state offense. This is not part of what the FBI is supposed to be doing. I then filed a Freedom of Information request with the Miami FBI office, asking for their files on Lennon to see what their response to this was. They replied to me that their John Lennon file had been destroyed as a part of a routine file destruction procedure.
Hmm.
Now, I have to note that Lennon files were collected in five other cities, and none of those places destroyed their Lennon files. So we wonder what was in the Miami Lennon file that was destroyed.
Now, you have the FBI document that explains why the FBI stopped its surveillance of Lennon. Would you summarize and read an excerpt of that document for us?
This is dated August 30th, 1972. This is like 2 months before the presidential election. This is a memo to the acting director. Now, that's L. Patrick Gray. J. Edgar Hoover had died in May, from the special agent in charge of the New York FBI office. It says, "For the past several months, there has been no information received to indicate that the subject is active in the new left." Then it indicates what the sources are. "All advised that during the month of July 1972 that the subject has fallen out of favor of activists Jerry Rubin, Stuart Albert, and Rennie Davis due to subject's lack of interest in committing himself to involvement in anti-war and new left activities. In view of this information, the New York Division is placing this case in a pending inactive status."
Now, is that true of the whole FBI or just the New York Division?
Well, New York was the office of origin, the OO, as it's called in the files. They're the ones who are responsible for conducting the investigation. I mean, what this really is saying here is that the Immigration Service and the FBI have succeeded in pressuring Lennon to cancel his plans for this national concert tour and to withdraw from anti-war activity. His lawyers told him that his case for fighting deportation was a pretty weak one. In fact, they'd never seen anyone win a case under these terms. And therefore, the legal advice was don't do anything more that would further provoke the Nixon administration. he really wanted to stay in the United States. Yoko was involved at that point in a custody dispute over her daughter from a previous marriage, her daughter Kyoko. So, John, if he had been deported, Yoko would have stayed behind. He didn't want to be separated from Yoko. So he canceled the plans for the concert tour. He dropped out of movement activity, and the FBI is reporting that they've accomplished their job.
So in that sense, the FBI did succeed in neutralizing, as they like to put it, in neutralizing John Lennon.
Yeah, neutralizing is one of the scary words which appear in the file. Some people think this refers, you know, to assassination plans or something like that. I don't think that's the case. Neutralizing means silencing him, getting him out of the picture through this deportation threat. And there's no question that Lennon was silenced as a spokesman of the anti-war movement.
How much do you think John Lennon knew about the FBI's surveillance of him?
Well, he understood that this whole deportation thing was politically motivated. He complained publicly on TV shows, on the Mike Douglas show, on the Dick Cavett show, you know, these criminal enterprises, that too many people were coming to fix his phones down on Bank Street in the West Village, and that there were strange men outside in suits who followed him around. He eventually sued the FBI, claiming he had been the target of illegal wiretapping. Part of his FBI file is the FBI's own response to that charge. They replied that they could find no evidence of authorized wiretapping in their files. Now, this seems to me like a typical Nixon-era non-denial denial. They said they could find no evidence, but maybe they didn't look very hard. They said they could find no evidence of authorized wiretapping, but it could have been unauthorized. It's also possible that the wiretapping was not done by the FBI, but was done by the New York police or some other agency. So Lennon sometimes thought he was just being paranoid. He would say, you know, he wasn't important enough to be the target of this kind of surveillance. At other times, he loudly proclaimed that he was the target of government persecution. It turns out it's the second that was correct, but he never was sure in his own time that it was the FBI that was after him.
Do you have evidence that his phone really was tapped?
There are no wiretapping logs in the Lennon FBI file of the kind that there are, say, in the Martin Luther King file. So this remains an open question. I mean, he lived next door to John Cage on Bank Street, and whenever he needed to make a, it's the '60s. It's the West Village in the '60s. Whenever he needed to make a secure conversation, they would go next door and use John Cage's phone in the belief that the FBI didn't know who John Cage was. They're probably right about that.
Right, the FBI wasn't interested in chance music, huh?
Probably not.
You know, you say in your book that one of the things you really find fascinating about these FBI files is that they document an era when rock music seemed to have real political force. Say some more about that.
Well, you know, it's a little hard to believe today that a president would fear the power of a rock star. Rock stars often today have political causes, but they're usually the safe ones, you know, save the rainforest or fight breast cancer or something like that, issues that nobody is going to, try to deport you for advocating. It's still hard to figure out whether the effort to deport Lennon was complete paranoia on Nixon's part. After all, Nixon did win the 1972 election by an overwhelming landslide. His opponent, George McGovern, carried, two or three states, something like that. So maybe the whole thing was just paranoia on the part of Nixon matched by paranoia on the part of Lennon and his friends. On the other hand, all of this was put in motion long before that presidential election, you know, in the winter beforehand. And at that point, I don't think it was clear to anybody that Nixon was going to win in a landslide. Nixon was concerned about this youth vote and how that might affect the elections. It wasn't clear that McGovern was going to be the candidate. There's a lot of reasons not to like Richard Nixon. I never liked him very much myself. But, you know, he was one of the most successful political candidates in recent history. So I'm kind of willing to accept Nixon's judgment that Lennon's political plans for 1972 were significant, were interesting, and, you know, did merit some kind of presidential response.
And that's something that you find interesting about the times and something that you admire Lennon for.
Yeah, I mean, Lennon really took risks here of a kind that you hardly see anybody ever taking. How many people in the entertainment world have faced deportation because of their political actions? I mean, what, Charlie Chaplin was sort of run out of the United States. Paul Robeson left. It was sort of the opposite, where he was denied the right to travel, and then he left the, you know, anyway. Bertolt Brecht fled after being quizzed by HUAC. This is a very small group of people. So I think it underscores the intensity of Lennon's commitment. I mean, I don't think he knew the risks he was taking, but that's sort of what he was like. He was a risk taker. He wanted to stand up for what he believed in. He wasn't going to play it safe. It wasn't a safe age. So I think that's admirable.
John Wiener, I thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Historian John Wiener speaking to Terry Gross in the year 2000. His book about the FBI investigation of John Lennon is called Gimme Some Truth. John Lennon, who was murdered in 1980, would have turned 70 tomorrow. On our website, you can link to an op-ed by John Wiener in today's LA Times and read letters supporting Lennon's case to stay in the country written by Bob Dylan, John Cage, and others. That's at freshair.npr.org. Two misery-filled comedies open this week, Tamara Drew and It's Kind of a Funny Story. The first unfolds at a writer's retreat in the English countryside, the second inside the psych ward of a New York hospital. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Tamara Drew is based on a graphic novel by Posy Simmons, which was inspired by Thomas Hardy's Far From the Madding Crowd. And after a spate of graphic novel movies that aim inexplicably, strenuously, and self-defeatingly to evoke their source material, it's a relief to find one that puts the spirit of the thing ahead of the form. Director Stephen Frears gets the feel of Simmons' frames, busy but airy, the characters looking especially precarious against the fixed landscapes. Gemma Arterton's Tamara Drew, chatty lifestyle columnist for a London newspaper, is the last character to arrive in this small English backwater. But she's the catalyst, setting everything in madcap motion. She has two key attributes. She's utterly gorgeous, showing up in a pair of short shorts and riveting the gaze of men and women both. And she knows that her gorgeousness is provisional. She grew up with a near Cyrano-sized honker she had fixed, and now she can't quite believe her new power. Because this is Hardy-inspired, there's an unusually large number of perspectives. Tamsin Grieg's Beth Hardiment owns this writer's retreat with her husband, best-selling mystery writer Nicholas. She doesn't just cook and clean. She's a kind of muse, giving him ideas and typing his handwritten drafts. But the aging fop cheats on her like mad, which gives hope to the schlubby, radiantly unsuccessful Hardy scholar played by American stage actor Bill Camp. Perhaps he thinks Beth could be his muse. Luke Evans is the dreamy handyman who loves Tamara. Dominic Cooper, the rock star drummer who plays his sticks up and down her body to seduce her. And there are two local high school girls, Casey and Jody, who sneak into Tamara's house and send a lascivious email in her name that ushers in the apocalypse. In its unpretentious way, Tamara Drew has the fullness of an 18th century novel in which fate is inexorable. Character equals destiny, and there are casualties. But in place of Hardy's pathos is a perverse little smile that's blessedly contagious. It's Kind of a Funny Story is also set on the border between funny and discomforting. It opens with its narrator, Craig, played by Kerr Gilchrist, having a vision of himself jumping off the Brooklyn Bridge. Vaguely suicidal, he talks his way into a psychiatric ward. He has a dad, played by Jim Gaffigan, who's not particularly verbal, but whose driving ambition for the boy has reduced him to a wreck. Craig has a best friend with a 4.6 grade point average. How, he asks, is that even possible? And a relationship with the girl Craig adores. More pressing is an unfinished summer school application that his father believes holds the key to future success. With all the ingredients for a self-pitying, narcissistic adolescent fantasy, the movie manages to be offhand. As in Ned Vizzini's endearingly nervous novel, directors Ryan Fleck and Anna Boden keep one eye on the protagonist and the other on the patients. One is a girl who cuts herself, who's played by the impossibly pretty Emma Roberts, and her immediate rapport with Craig is enough to make most teenage males think about signing themselves into the local hospital. Her character is a stretch. But the one who dominates the movie is slobby, bearded Zach Galifianakis's Bobby, who first appears to Craig in the emergency room waiting area, dressed in a doctor's white coat and scrubs.
How you doing? You got a cigarette?
No, sorry.
What's wrong with you?
I just don't smoke.
No, I mean, why are you in an ER at 5 o'clock on a Sunday morning?
Well, I guess there's just been a lot going on in my mind lately.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, this is sort of difficult to explain. But, see, there's this girl.
Yeah, gotcha.
And this summer school application that I'm really nervous about.
Summer school?
Yeah, it's like this super prestigious kind of...
Why would you want to be in school in the summer? You should be on Coney Island bird dogging chicks.
Are you a doctor?
Galifianakis is stunningly good. His Bobby describes himself as on vacation from the world. And this is something of a working vacation for Galifianakis, too. He slows himself down, takes a breather from his manic comedian persona, and allows something melancholy and bitter to emerge. His Bobby understands the pressure Craig is under to perform. It's kind of a funny story, is too tidy and often too cute. What saves it is the director's soft sell. It's not about breakthroughs, epiphanies, one-size-fits-all cures for depression. It's about seeing one's own confusion in a larger context and learning that misery really does love company.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.